Wir haben noch mehr von seiner Wortbeschreibung erlaubt, denn in vielen Regeln pose the justice to politics and offer all members an equal opportunity. The structure has reflected the plan suggested there is a vacancy in the post of Provincial Commissioner KZN and Divisional Commissioner Forensic Services. It is incorrect and such posts are not vacant. If you reflect the acting in DPCI, why not reflect acting in other posts? It's there on page 7 from the police report. Attention should be paid to cancelling of members at the beginning of capacity position. Program 2, Digital Policy. The current plan provision does not seem to be satisfied. We should guard against returning to a situation where everyone would move from the main director instead of assisting. Police killing does not seem to receive the attention that it deserves while police continue to lose their lives. There is not a single word on the police killings in this document. The previous plans ended in planning stages with an fair implementation. The injection of such intention by the minister is appreciated. Honorable Chair, we need to emphasize on this point of police killings. An attack to the police is an attack to the state. And we request the police to do more in terms of this police killings. Program 3, Detective Services. The setting of the detection rate for property-related crime at 14.43% means that we are planning to have 85.57 undetected rate. This may be interpreted as adoption of pessimistic approach, which will not instill confidence in our ability. The program has a sub-program for specialized investigation. There is direct contrast with Section 17H4D and 17K2 of the Police Act that requires a program, not a sub-program. It seems that compliance with the provisions of this law, it is not going to be realized. There are two options. Management should either implement the law or ask the legislature to remove the stumbling block by amending the act. Program 3, Continuing Detective Service. The following are concerned about the DPCI's plan. It is not measuring the conviction rate. It has abandoned a measurement about prosecution in terms of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act 121 of 1998. The plan is silent about the statutory ministerial committee as provided in Section 17I of the Police Act. The plan is silent about the statutory operational committee as required in the Section 17J of the Police Act. The Criminal Record Center is not measured on the performance around the crime scene and identification of perpetrators. Program 4, Crime Intelligence. The division should have clear targets regarding the finalization of security clearance certificate. It must be known as to how many members of the organization who are required to have security clearance and how many are still outstanding. The division should also be in a position to know as to when are the existing certificate expiring. In that way, it will not only clear members for the purpose of appointment or when there is public outcry, but will do so at all times to make sure that things are in order. We don't want to find a situation where people are appointed at higher post and they are not security. Right. While the division generates profiles for reactive policing, there is no performance indicator to measure the number of organized criminal groups identified. This explains the minimal organized crime project investigation in the DPCI. The drop on the number of criminal groups from 500 in 1999-2000 to 62 in 2016-2017 does not suggest eradication of criminality but a handicap in gathering of intelligence. Program 5, Protection and Security Service. Now, Rochelle, we are comfortable with the plan around the Protection Security Services Program. Recommendation from SACO. We recommend that Section 17H4D and 17KD of the Police Act regarding a distinct performance program of the Directorate be amended. If not, a distinct program as opposed to a sub-program within a detective services program must be designed. Crime Intelligence Division and DPCI must refocus and deal with organized crime, criminal groups as a joint venture. Crime intelligence must be capacitated to conduct security clearances to ensure that members are assessed. In conclusion, Honourable Member and Honourable Members, we as SAP will always offer our contribution to the police leadership. I thank you.
Thank you very much for that presentation. Members, is there any questions of clarification? Right, thank you very much. I think one important point that's coming through, and we will have to, in our interrogation of the DPCI, deal with that, the issue of the ministerial committee. Members will remember that during our joint meeting with the NPA, we also indicated that it is one of the current gaps, and also the issue of the independence of the DPCI. So if the ministerial committee, as well as the operational committee, is not effective and up and running, it's going to be very difficult for them to be effective. And also, of course, the issue of the program, but also maybe the researcher and the content advisor can maybe comment on that later, the whole issue of a separate budget. There is a clear indication in the SAPS Act that there must be a separate budget brought to this committee on the DPCI budget. Now, has that been done? Why not? If not capacity, we'll have to have clarity on that during this next few days. So I just want to flag that and maybe get comments from the researcher and later in this morning. Members, anything else? All right, thank you very much to SAPU. We appreciate your input, and I think these points that's raised will be taken up by members during the deliberations. Thank you very much. We will now give an opportunity to the Social Justice Coalition as the second group that will give input. Also welcome to Mr. Newham from ISS. Welcome to him. I don't know, is Corruption Watch here? Not yet. Right. Let's see the copy of that.
Good morning. Honourable members, and to the comrades and colleagues who are here today. My apologies for not sending the presentation. Dali and I thought we were going to send, I thought Dali was going to send it, and he thought I was going to send it, so apologies for that. But you can see the presentation on the slide. So just a brief intro of the SJC. We are a democratic membership-based social movement that is currently based in Cape Town, and the majority of our members are working class and poor individuals with 2,000 members in informal settlements across Cape Town.
You can go ahead. Fine.
My presentation will focus on So I'm going to focus on these three parts of my presentation, but it's mainly going to look at the first three under FEPs, legal fees and liabilities, and I'm going to touch on the IPs part and the civilian secretariat part. So under the legal fees and liabilities, I'm going to talk briefly about the police resources court case, which you will all be aware of. Which was finalized earlier this year, this week for the judgment. I'm going to talk about the Constitutional Court's appeal of the Regulation of the Gatherings Act judgment, the judgment which was handed over earlier this year, which SAPS is currently appealing at the Constitutional Court, and some of the dealings we've had in terms of unlawful acts by SAPS and law enforcement officers of the City of Cape Town in terms of the Prevention of Illegal Eviction and Unlawful Occupation Act, Land Act, sorry. So in terms of the SAPS legal fees, in March 2016, you would remember that the SJC, and we were represented by the Legal Resources Center, along with our partner organization, Equal Education, together at the time with the Nyanga Community Police Forum, we had launched a case against the South African Police Services, and we launched this at the Equality Court, where we were saying that the manner in which police resources are distributed discriminates on the basis of race and on the basis of poverty. And our application was to try and review and change the inequitable and irrational allocation of police resources in poor and working class communities. After a challenge of the Nyanga Community Police Forum, was given leave to intervene and is the third applicant in the case. But I'm going to talk a bit more about that later on. So in terms of the fees, so in this court case, SAPS had three legal representatives, and I'm just going to outline what to us is very concerning in terms of the delays, which costs quite a lot for the three legal representatives that SAPS had in this court case. So the first one is when the Nyanga Community Police Forum wanted to join the case, SAPS refused and they opposed the Nyanga Police Forum to join. And therefore that meant that we had to have another trial within this trial, so that the court could hear why SAPS opposes the Nyanga Community Police Forum to join. SAPS failed, and the Nyanga Community Police Forum was admitted to join the case. The second part of the delay was that SAPS requested an extension for them to file their papers. They were given a deadline to file their papers. They requested an extension beyond the 30th of November 2016. And the deadline was the 5th of December 2016. Again, SAPS failed to file their papers, though they had requested an extension. The papers weren't filed in January. They weren't filed in February, up until we had to launch a chamber book application to force SAPS to file the papers. The court directed SAPS to file the papers by the 7th of Feb in 2017. SAPS failed to file the papers. The papers were filed in bits and pieces between the 17th of Feb and the 13th of March. And these delays, again, think about the three legal representatives that that SAPS has in this court case. And then the lawyers for the SJC, EE and Nyanga, under legal exploration, requested that SAPS's resources, national allocation data, be given to us for the 1,140 police precincts across the country. And we requested for this information on three occasions. We only received this this data a month later. This contributed to more delays in terms of this court case. And then at one of the public meetings where the Deputy Minister of Police attended, and our then General Secretary, Phumeza Mlungwana, raising this issue of police resources, the Deputy Police Minister said, and I quote, "We are going to agree with you because if we speak about partnership of the police with the people, therefore the people must not be hostile, therefore the police must not be hostile to the progressive demands of the people. The police should support the progressive agenda of the people because it is the police of the people, not the police of the system. So we are not going to contest you." And in our view, the minister was saying that the SAPS is no longer going to challenge or to oppose the court case. In response, we had to write to the legal representatives of SAPS to get an idea whether this is the case. And we were informed that the litigation will proceed. So this court case continued, and as you will be aware, it took 3 days in November 2017 for the case to be finalized. It wasn't finished within those 3 days. There had to be another extension till February this year. I think that was 14th and 15th of Feb this year. And if you would look at the records of the court, you would see that SAPS spent over 75% of the time arguing in the case. I would say that we spend about around 25% of the time, and again, this is three legal representatives of SEPs that I'm sure are billed by the hour in terms of this work. And they are challenging something that they're very likely to lose. The second part of these legal fees is this issue of the challenge of the Constitutional Court appeal on the Regulation of Gatherings Act. So just a brief history. The Western Cape High Court Judge Ndita, delivered a landmark judgment in the so-called SJC 10 case that has major repercussions on the freedom of assembly in South Africa. The judge overturned convictions of 10 SJC activists who had been arrested under the Regulation of the Gatherings Act. And I think one of those is here. This happened during a picket that we had outside the mayor's office where we were protesting around issues of sanitation services. And we had chained ourselves to the railings of the civic center in a peaceful and organized act of civil disobedience. After the court process during the judgment, the historic judgment ruled that Section 12A of the Gatherings Act is unconstitutional because it limits, and secondly, this is very important, it criminalizes peaceful protest. The ruling does not affect the conditions, this is what the judgment says, the convictions under the Gatherings Act, and any future contravictions of the Act will not result in an arrest and a criminal record. So it meant that anyone who had protested after the ruling would not be convicted criminally if they had protested peacefully without providing notice. The judgment stated that the criminalization of a gathering of more than 15 on the basis that no notice was given violates Section 17 of the Constitution, as it deters people from exercising their fundamental right to assembly peacefully and unarmed. The limitation is not reasonable and justifiable in an open and democratic society based on the values of freedom, dignity, and equality. Therefore, Section 12(1)(a) of the RGA is hereby declared unconstitutional. And this is what the Gatherings Act defines a gathering. Firstly, it defines a convener. A convener is any person who, of his own accord, convenes a gathering. And in relation to any organization or branch of any organization, any person appointed by such organization or branch in terms of Section 2(1). In terms of the definition of the gathering, it means any assembly, concourse, or procession of more than 15 persons in or any public road as defined in the Road Traffic Act, or any other public place or premise wholly or partially open to the air. And then it goes further, Section 1A, at which the principles, policy, actions, or failure to act of any government, political party, or political organization, whether or not that party or organization is registered in terms of any applicable law, are discussed, attacked, criticized, promoted, or propagated, or held to form pressure groups to hand over petitions to any person or to mobilize or demonstrate support for or opposition to the views, principles, policies, action, or omission of any person, of any person or body or institution, including any government administration. And you would wonder why I'm giving all these explanations, but I'm going to get into that very soon. And then Section 12, which was declared unconstitutional in terms of offenses and penalties, says any person who convenes a gathering in respect of which no notice or adequate notice was given in accordance to Section 3 shall be guilty of an offense and on conviction liable to a fine or to imprisonment for a period not exceeding 1 year or to both such a fine and such imprisonment. This is why 21 SJC members were arrested, and this is why 10 of them were convicted criminally, and they currently have criminal records. I'm going to give a very quote an example of why this is very problematic. The president of the country convened a gathering without providing notice. In his tweet, he convened a gathering saying, "A very good morning to you all. I invite you to join me for my morning walk tomorrow morning at 5 a.m. We will be walking together from Khayelitsha to Mitchell's Plain in Cape Town." This is in ANC colors. This is a political party, which means by the definition of the Gatherings Act, this was a gathering. The discussions there were political. The president was discussing, and we attended the gathering. We were part of the gathering. The president was discussing, and he was inviting people to register to vote, and that's a political issue. He was saying, he was discussing his Tuma Mina campaign. The current Gatherings Act means that the president can be criminalized according to what it says now, according to the definition. And the president should be criminalized. As 10 SJC members were criminalized, we requested from the city of Cape Town, we wrote to the city of Cape Town to ask whether the president provided notice for his gathering. The response was that, and we hired for this, the response was that the prior was refused. And it was refused on the basis that no notice was given, on the basis that the notice did not exist. Therefore, the president did not provide notice when he was convening his gathering. So what we're trying to say here is that we have challenged this act, and the High Court has agreed with us. And SEPS is saying that people should be criminalized. And this is money that is being wasted on legal fees at the Constitutional Court. And it's very likely that SEPS is going to lose this this challenge. And to move on, the third example that I'm going to make is with regards to the prevention of illegal evictions and unlawful occupation of land act. This act says that no person may evict an unlawful occupier except on the authority of an order of a competent court. And I think it's going to be very important, especially for members of parliament, to take notice of the many evictions that are currently happening, illegal evictions that are currently happening in the current land debate in the country. Section 8 further goes that any person who contravenes a provision of subsection 1 or 2 is guilty of an offense and liable to a conviction. Liable on conviction to a fine or to imprisonment, not exceeding 2 years, or both such fine and such imprisonment. Any person whose rights or interests have been prejudiced by a contravention of subsection 1 has the right to institute a private prosecution of the alleged offender. And this is very important. There's a recent case that was in the news. About Muga Hill local municipality, where on the 6th of October in the Eastern Cape, where this municipality demolished 36 homes on the property known as the Nuras community, situated on a portion of that particular land. On the 18th of October, the Grahamstown High Court offered the families urgent relief because they were illegally evicted and they were not provided with alternative accommodation. And the order was saying that the municipality must construct emergency temporary habitable tents or similar dwellings that afford shelter, privacy, and amenities for the 36 families. And that the municipalities and others were interdicted and restrained from threatening and harassing the 36 families. This municipality did not abide by this court ruling. And the mayor and the municipal manager had knowledge of the order, but they failed in their duties to ensure that the court order was justly executed. And then on Friday, the 13th of April, the Nuras community witnessed justice in action when the mayor, Mr. Patrick Mdingi, was arrested for being in contempt of the court order, together with the municipal manager, Luleki Fihlani. Because the mayor refused to build emergency shelters for the communities whose homes were unlawfully demolished in October 2016 by the Mozo municipality. And I think it's very important to take note of who exactly is normally involved when homes are being demolished. It's law enforcement officer, it's the South African Police Services. The mayor has been committed to prison for a period of 30 days, although the current whereabouts of the municipal manager are unknown. A warrant of his arrest has also been issued. This is an eviction that happened in Khayelitsha on the 13th of March in 2018. Those are South African Police Services officers. A huge number of them, which when there are crimes being committed in informal settlements, you never see such a number of police officers in those informal settlements. Those South African police officers were there and they witnessed and they were part of breaking the law. They were part of illegally evicting people that had occupied land unlawfully. The fact that people occupied land unlawfully does not mean that law enforcement officers can act in any way and can act against the law. PIE is very clear that a court order has to be there before people are evicted. There was no court order on the 13th of March, and people's homes were destroyed with the assistance of the South African Police Services. Those people could have easily taken the South African Police Services to court, and again, it would come to this legal fees that SAFS would have to pay those individual people for the destruction of those homes. And the fact that also, this is something that's not in this presentation, also a lot of these evictions happened. So three evictions happened after this one. And after this one, it was many law enforcement officers of the city of Cape Town that were involved for illegally evicting the people. The people have the right, and according to PIE, the PIE Act, they have the right to go and open a case at the SAFS, at the South African Police Service. I was there, I assisted them in opening a case, and SAFS refused to open a case. And that's illegal for SAFS, for South African police officers to refuse to open a case. This is just one case. Think about some of the cases that might be refused. Think about sexual violence case that might be refused to be opened at the South African police office, police station in places such as Khayelitsha, that you might not be aware of, and that I also would not be aware of. I wouldn't be aware of this particular case if it wasn't there at the police station at the time. So what we're recommending is that the legal fees can be and should be reduced, because a lot of these challenges that SAPS is challenging are challenges that they are very likely to lose. These are principles and rational judgments that should not be appealed by the South African police services, such as the one of the Gatherings Act. And that SAFS faces countless liabilities and accrues costs readily, SAFS must adhere to the rule of law. All law enforcement officers must adhere to the rule of law. No one is above the law and the constitution. And that SAFS must not assist other levels of government when they are breaking the law, such as the incident that happened in Khayelitsha a few months ago. So just to close to conclusion, in terms of visibility and advertising, in terms of IP, and this is very important again, because I was there and being a member of the Social Justice Coalition, knowing about IP and its role, and knowing about other oversight institutions that exist for me to report, it's very easy for me. But if I was not there, any other individual that lives in Khayelitsha who do not know about IPIT, it's very difficult for those people to respect, to report when these issues of criminality to a certain extent happen by the South African Police Services. So what we're saying in terms of IPIT is that one of the things that should be done is that visibility and advertising budget must be increased. The amount that is currently there is very little in terms of IP. People that go to the police station in Harare police station don't know about IP. People in informal settlement in Khayelitsha don't know about IP, and they don't know to report where to report when the law is being broken by law enforcement officers. So that's our recommendation in terms of the IP budget. Because if you look at that particular budget, it's 1.3% of the average budget for stakeholder management that is dedicated to visibility and advertising. And people need to know about these oversight and institutions. Lastly, in terms of the civilian secretariat, we are saying that when the civilian secretariat considers the promulgation of the CPF regulations, they must take notice of jurisprudence that exists, specifically also in relation to the recent court case, in the police resources court case, where SET refused for the CPF to activate its role as an independent body that monitors the South African police services. Because the CPF wanted to join a case that was saying that police resources are distributed in a manner that is discriminatory, SET refused, and they refused the powers of the CPF in terms of its oversight roles. And what we're saying is that when the civilian secretariat does its work in relation to community police forum, they must take notice of this judgment that was handed by the Western Cape High Court, that CPFs must be empowered to be as independent as possible, so that they are not co-opted by the police, because they are not employed by the South African Police Services. They are there to assist the police and to monitor in terms of SET doing its work. I think that's the end of my presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I think it raises very important issues, especially the issue with regard to SAPs acting within the legal prescripts, the issue of illegal occupations. There's a very comprehensive, I think, national instruction of 2017. Now, the big question is that national instruction available at station or unit level? So that's an issue that we will have to take up. Also, the issue of legal cost. Apart from the contract management issues that we will raise this afternoon, it's quite clear that the decisions with regard to legal cases and the risks associated with it, there's serious problems. Also, with regard to IPED, we agree, I think, there needs to be much more budgetary allocations available to ensure that they are properly advertised and available to the community. But let's give members, is there any issues, Honourable Mhlongo and Honourable Mbele?
No, thank you, Chairperson. I've got two questions of clarity. One, with this question of Gatherings Act, its enforcement, I myself, I am not really that happy. I have, for example, raised it with sharp concerns when over 20,000 people assembled in Durban, addressed by former President Zuma, without even the notice by the South African Police Service, not even the acting provincial commissioner, was caught with his pants down. When the entire town of Durban was caught in a standstill, heavily armed, those people who were called the Amabutho, impis, threatening security, national security of the country. Not even one person. Now, you just say, what kind of a law is this thing? Does it mean that there is one person who can just look at, and when you get innocent people who are raising genuine issues, need to be a major subject of harassment? Really, such law, application of law to me, is a non-starter, because it's a problem. But what I wanted to find out from you is, have you decided to make a presentation or similar presentation to the Justice Committee as a responsible committee to look into the amendment of these sections of the Gatherings Act, which I think, if I look at it, the section that you referred to in terms of the South African Police Service Act is actually then in line with that particular section of the Gatherings Act. Though then the chairperson is talking of the national instruction, but as long as then the Act says something, that national instruction might actually then be overturned depending who amongst the police officers is actually then responding to that particular thing. So that is question one. Then question two, with this question of civilian secretariat, I have serious reservations about this, because civilian secretariat is a national organ of state. But when it comes to provinces, that's where the mess is. That's why in KZN, for example, you have got the head of provincial secretariat, who's a former member of MKMV, or who's a member of MKMVA, promoting people to repel and close even the national road in the toll gate of Lukman. Now, threatening national security, but being part and parcel of people who must actually ensure public safety of the people. Now, because this thing is now, it is taking a federal shape in provinces, such that the national secretariat director has got no authority over provincial secretariat, then it depends which party is ruling in that particular province. And then this thing, to me, it undermines coherence. Because if you have got a particular party that is reactionary in a particular province, it means the civilian secretariat will also take the form of that particular political leadership that is in the office. Because of the section that was explained to us as the committee of the Constitution, which actually then created these MECs for safety and security, whose role to me, I don't even understand what their role is. Now, have you actually thought of actually then making submissions so that South African Parliament will actually look into the amendment of the Constitution of the Republic, which I think on a build-up to 1994, it created a kind of, because policy, because of Bantustan and all that and all police organs, it was a highly contested terrain. We don't have that particular threat right now. But now it creates a mess in terms of coherency, of empowering our people in the provinces, because it depends, as long as provincial secretaries are appointed on party lines in the provinces, these things will just remain toothless and useless. They will never empower people. They will just serve political bosses' interests, not people's interests. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Shlungu, Honourable Mabele, and then Honourable Molabatsi, and then Honourable Mabija.
Apologies to my late arrival, and thank you very much. Just two questions from the SJC presentation. Firstly, in terms of the police resources case, thanks, Diane. In terms of the police resources case, I mean, clearly this is a case of SAP's obstructionism, and there are other stakeholders who have had a similar experience. I know from the committee's time over the past year or so, the firearm owner sector has also been having similar issues of obstructionism. Now, I believe that a key contributing structural factor to the situation that you're trying to address with this court case, the understaffing, under-resourcing, and under-equipping at station level, is the facts of centralized top-down management in the police service. Which means that often top management is making decisions that are out of touch with grassroots reality, and station managements and operational officers on the ground are at the whims of those kind of decisions, which then manifest as the skewed priorities that we often see reflected in the budgets and in the APP. And of course, this problem is exacerbated when you have management that is not fit for purpose making those decisions. In my personal oversight visits, I am yet to meet a station commander who disagreed with the idea
said that if they were vested with greater authority and more control of the resources that drive policing strategies, that station and activities would not be more effective. So my simple question to the SJC, because it speaks very much to the issue of police resources distribution, is would you agree that an approach which localizes the police service, both in terms of budgets and management authority, is a key reform required so that station commanders have the means and the ability to customize their policing strategies and make them suitable to their contexts? That's my first question. And then secondly, on the gatherings issue, I've always been very clear, even before the court ruling earlier this year, that there is no such thing in this country as an illegal protest or gathering or strike. You only have a protected or unprotected one. So the mere fact of gathering, even if you're over that 15-person threshold, is neither here nor there. You are constitutionally allowed to do that. Where the issue does come in is that if it is an unprotected gathering or strike, if the police arrive on the scene and they assess that there's some threat to law and order, whatever the case might be, if they give an instruction to disperse, that must be complied to. Obviously, if such an instruction is ever given irrationally, it can be challenged subsequently. But I just wanted to get clear, given that's my understanding. So the January ruling merely clarified and maybe gave some substance to that. But that's certainly has always been the line. So would the SJC agree with the importance of that provision for compliance with the police instruction to disperse? Because I do know there was a big concern from managers of law enforcement with the January ruling that it creates an open door for just a free-for-all and complete anarchy if it's misinterpreted as saying that there's just nothing law enforcement can do when people gather because it's unconditional and unqualified rights. And just to close off, it's worth mentioning that technically that walk by the president, because it was post January ruling, actually was legal. But that's neither here nor there. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Bailey. Honourable Mulabatsi.
Thank you, Chairperson. From your input, it's quite clear that in your community, the community is not aware of how IPs can they are not aware of the activities of IPs and how IPs can help in reporting of misconduct by the police. And now my question is, seeing that you are based in that community, are you maybe considering some awareness of some kind to help to make the community aware of the help they can get from IP to report misconduct by police? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Mabija.
Thank you, Chairperson. Honourable Mulevade, has gone through my mind. I'm covered about what she's been saying. Now, I'm only left with a question to know whether the Social Justice Coalition make usage of your modus operandi is of crisis management intervention only, because you just come in after something has happened. That's why I say I'm covered by the awareness campaigns and what she's been saying. Or you just move with what is happening without preventing.
Thank you. Also welcome to Mr. Lewis and delegation from Corruption Watch. You're very much welcome. Honorable Kalabana.
Yeah, just a reaction to what has been suggested my colleagues have been putting forward various comments. It's not really up to the Social Justice Coalition to promote the IFED. IFED, we know, since its inception, been a Cinderella body. It's paid for, but imagine you having to pay the salaries of an entity that actually does oversight over you. I know they have a different vote, but it's all smooshed together. It's one vote. There are no separate debates. So that's just window dressing. They do the best they can with the little budget they have. And I agree absolutely. As long as South African citizens do not know that the IFED exists, they don't know where to go. When a cop beats them up or rapes them or what. They go to the police station and say, your friend that you have lunch with every day and share coffee with has just attacked me. Yeah, okay. Write it here on this piece of paper which then gets thrown in the bin. I've seen it happen. I've heard it happen many times. So until our citizenry are fully aware of the powers of the IFED, they're hamstrung. And I agree absolutely they should know, but it's not your job to promote a government institution. It is their job, and it is the job of this body to make sure they have sufficient funds to do that. So that's my opinion on the subject.
Thank you very much. Honourable Mabija, if you've got an additional question.
Thank you, Chairperson. I'd like to put it in a simple way, the gist of what I've been saying and been covered by Honorable Moleba. I don't mean yourselves, a social justice coalition, to run workshops and campaigns, aware campaigns to market IPED. I mean to make people aware all your jurisdiction area to be aware what is antisocial to your social justice coalition around the environment, to assist them to know precisely what to do, how to do it, where to go, blah 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 blah. Not to market IPs. That must be very clear. Thank you.
Thank you, honourable members. You're welcome to respond. Some of it was comments. There's a few questions. You're welcome.
I think the presentation to the Justice Committee is definitely something that we'll consider, and we'll see how we can take that forward. The issue of, it always has been a worry, the issue of party politics, especially when it comes to SAPs coming into play. And we saw this towards the Commission of Inquiry into Khayelitsha, when we asked the Premier to institute the Commission of Inquiry, and it was challenged nationally, but the Premier was exercising her constitutional role, which is there in the Constitution. But I think in terms of the civilian secretariat, this is not something that we've really digged deep into, but I'm sure my colleagues have taken note of that, and we'll look into that as well. The issue of police resources, what we've been saying, and this is what we've been saying in the court case, that this formula that clearly, I think, as you've said, is managed at the national level. It's called the THRR, the Theoretical Human Resource Requirement, where numbers from police station are put together, and this formula just gives out a number for police for police resources to be distributed. And one of the arguments in the court case was that even provincial commissioners don't have the power to redistribute police within their provinces. If an instruction comes from national government in terms of this formula, then that's how it must be done. So the fact that even provincial commissioners don't have that power is very problematic. And we're not necessarily, and in the court case we've said that, we're not necessarily saying how this should be done. We're saying that there's experts, there's examples from other countries in terms of how this has been done. What we've said in the court case is that this must be reviewed. There must be space for the police, for civil society, for experts to come together and say, this is clearly discriminatory and it's wrong. And there must be space for this to be debated so that a clear and equal way of distributing policies can be agreed to by society as a whole. And it's not necessarily up to the SJC to say how police should be distributed. But the fact that it's only directed there at national level for people who never even put their foot on the ground is very problematic. And in terms of the Gatherings Act, what our problem has been was that we're not saying that people should not provide notice, firstly. We're saying that people should not be criminalized just because they have not provided notice. And when a lot of protests become violent, everyone who's part of that gathering, most of the times gets those people, because of the current act, those people would be criminalized. But we know that there's other crimes. So if it's violence, then that must be violence. That must not be an illegal gathering. Because I also agree with you, there's no such thing as an illegal gathering. Because everyone does have the right according to the Constitution. So if the issue is that the person did not respect the job of the officer, then that must be the crime. That must not be criminalization based on an illegal gathering, as the 10 SJC members who currently have criminal records now were criminalized. They were criminalized because they convened an illegal gathering. That's the main reason why they were criminalized. The last issue in terms of, we don't necessarily just react. When these evictions were happening, we were there. We asked for these people to stop what they were doing because it was illegal, because we were called by the community. So we do not react after the fact. And some of the issues now that we're raising, and I think it's very important also that since 2014, a lot of these issues could be resolved that have to do with the South African Police Service. The Khayelitsha Commission of Inquiry released a report with 20 recommendations in terms of how to transform in relation to how it's worked in Khayelitsha, but also across the country. The issue of police resources came from that. That was in 2014. It's 2018 now. A lot of those recommendations haven't been implemented. And one of the important recommendations, and this is something that was not in my presentation, which is very important, is this issue of guidelines for policing informal settlements. It does not only put a danger to people living in those informal settlements. The fact that SEPS officials are losing lives is because they are not trained to police informal settlements. There are no guidelines for policing informal settlements in the country. And millions of people are neglected in terms of policing informal settlements. SEPS can only, and you can see the way, in terms of the transportation of SEPS, it's vans that can only go through formal areas. For informal settlements, that's very difficult, and it's dangerous for SEPS officials. It's the clear case of Marikana the past few weeks is an example, where people were calling on SEPS to come in police, and SEPS was saying, no, it's dangerous. If it's dangerous for SEPS, then what does it mean for the people who are living in that particular informal settlement? Because there's no streets, and SEPS cannot police because there's no guidelines across the country, not only in Khayelitsha. So, to us, that's not a reactionary approach. That's an approach where we are being active. We're saying, implement these guidelines so that you can protect the lives of people in informal settlements, but also protect the lives of SEPS officials that are working in informal settlements. And then lastly, we are willing, and I agree, it's not our job, but we are willing to assist where we can. If IFIT has the resources, we don't have the resources, but we have a constituency in some of these areas. And so we are willing to assist in terms of making sure that people know about the job of IFIT and other oversight institutions that do exist. Thank you.
Thank you very much to the Social Justice Coalition and the presentation in Inkut. We appreciate. Thank you very much. We will now ask Mr. Gareth Newham from ISS. Your microphone, I think, Gareth.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and to the honourable members. It's always a huge honour to present to you and somewhere contribute to your very important work. As you know, the ISS works to try and better understand and assist policy and responses to improving community safety, reducing violence, particularly violent crime, improving policing and criminal justice system, and promoting violence prevention interventions. So this morning, as you'll see, I have a presentation which I have before you. I'm primarily going to talk about the South African Peace Service Annual Performance Plan for 2018 and 2019. But if I can answer questions on the other two plans,
yep.
I have read them, I'll be happy to try. I realized while preparing this presentation, it's been about 23 years since I started doing work on policing and with the South African Service. And probably the most exciting part of that work was when I was going out to police officers on the ground as part of their patrols, investigating crimes in places like Hillbrow, Alexander, Soweto. And that made me really think about the challenge that has been around in trying to measure police performance through number. Policing is often referred to as a craft. The environment in which police operate is constantly changing. Every day can bring something completely new. Sometimes police officers arrive at a scene where there are two people injured. They don't know who the perpetrator is. They don't know who the suspect is, or the victim, and both people are accusing each other. So they don't really always know what's going to happen and what circumstances they're going to find themselves in. So it's seen as a craft. They need to be highly skilled. They need to have a lot of experience, and they need to be continually trained to respond and meet the new challenges that they're facing every day. And at the end of that, basically their attitude and how they are trained and able to handle themselves that determines whether they do a good job or a bad job. But each one of them can help people in the community every day of their working careers, and many people join the police for that very purpose. They want to help people. Okay, so that's sort of, we understand that, but as I've read an interesting sort of a statement recently saying that best skilled, best experienced police officer with good attitudes can almost resolve any community conflict. Step into a situation of violence and help resolve it. Similarly, a highly skilled and experienced police official with a bad attitude can cause almost a riot in any community. And how do you put together a system that measures that in numbers is a vexed question. This is not new. There's at least 20 years of quite interesting research and reflections on how do you measure police performance. In a way that you can help them improve their capacity and ability to improve public safety. And more often than not, most police agencies around the world do not implement the lessons learned. And I'll speak a bit more about that. So overview is, I'm just really just quickly talk about the key objectives in our constitutional democracy. I'm just going to look at the situational analysis out of the medium-term strategic framework. That's basically supposed to help inform what the police are facing at the moment. Some of the indicators and targets in this plan, which I believe would actually undermine the ability of the South African Police Service to achieve their high-level outcomes. And then some general points about the APP and some points about how to move forward. Hopefully, we have another medium-term strategic period from 2020 to 2025, and we can revisit some of these indicators in a way that might help the police improve on what they're doing. Okay, so in a democracy, and in many ways, reading the statements made by the minister, by the national commissioner, and the entrance, the beginning, the forward of these plans, actually captures a lot of the stuff. There's a recognition that policing in democracies face what's called a double demand. It's a very nice way of understanding it. People want to feel safe. They want the police to do their jobs effectively They want to be to see the police that are trained and adhering to certain way of policing, but they also want the police to act professionally and fairly to people. So it's not only what they do, holding roadblocks, arresting criminals, stabilising areas which might be unstable or not safe, but they want to see the police do it in a way that's seen as respecting people's rights and dignity. And if you can do those two kind of things, and see those two outcomes, then you really can, you'll be seen as a more effective agency than not. The Geneva Guidebook on the Control of Armed Forces puts it in very simple terms, that the objective of a police agency in a democracy must be to build public trust and confidence. And that's absolutely necessary for effective policing. You literally, in a democracy, cannot be effective as a police agency if large numbers of people that you need to work with or police in order to identify criminals, solve crimes, if they don't trust you, they don't believe that you're going to do a good job. You must achieve that trust by standing outside of politics, and you must protect democratic political activities and processes. So allow people to vote, allow people to express themselves, make sure that you balance the rights in a way that is fair and just at all times. And then finally, when you do intervene in conflicts, which is inevitable, that you're guided by the principle that everybody's equal before the law. You're not seen to favor some people over others. Now, these are sort of very fundamental things, and there's a lot of literature that goes into various dimensions of policing and can get quite complicated, but ultimately I believe that police agencies that have these key things in mind seem to perform better than others. And very interestingly, the issue of public trust are mentioned by the Minister, by the National Commissioner, and the Minister also talks about the issue of youth crime prevention and the importance of reaching out to youth. And that made me just think about this very important finding of the Sherman Report far back in 1997, looking at what works in policing, and he simply says that the less respectful police are towards suspects and citizens generally, the less people will comply with the law. Changing the policing style may be as important as focusing on police substance, you know, how they behave, how they act, not just what they do. Making both the style and substance of police practices more legitimate in the eyes of the public, particularly high-risk juveniles, usually young men, may be one of the most important most effective long-term policing strategies for crime prevention. Because as we know, particularly in gang areas and in certain parts of Africa, it's a mark of honor to not respect the police, to be rude to the police, to attack them. And that's because of sometimes the way that that young men see the police. And so if the police orientate themselves to winning over young men, that is going to be a huge ability for them to win legitimacy throughout the community generally. Okay, so that's just the stuff that's been around for many decades if you read. Look into policing theory if you want to work. Now the SAPS performance framework comes from the government priority between 2014 and 2019, that government must ensure that all people in South Africa are and feel safe. And the medium-term strategic framework, developed by the Department of Planning, Monitoring and Evaluation of the Presidency, came up with 5 key indicators. And so these you'll see kind of inform a lot of the indicators that you'll see in some of the annual performance plans. They talk about a reduction in number of reported contact crimes, increase in proportion of citizens who feel safe walking alone during the day and night, proportion of households that are satisfied with the police in their areas, the extent to which people's perceptions of crime is measured, and then they have improving South Africa's ranking on the Transparency International Corruption Perception Index. I think some of these need to be revisited in the new strategic framework, but that's basically where the police start getting some of the indicators from. So if you use that to give a situation analysis, well, police do this in a situation analysis. It kind of gives you the following picture, that we know that total personnel numbers are going down, but the budget is still going up, and it's over 6% increase each year, so it's still above what is seen as the current inflation rate, which is a good thing, but it means that we don't see the big increase of 14% year on year. So really, what this simply means is that the police are going to have to become more efficient. They're going to have to do more, because most indicators in these, well, not all, but some of them are going up quite dramatically, I'll talk about that in a moment, but they have fewer people. So they have to work more with communities and have to be smarter in the way they do work. So that's the internal environment that's now facing. What I'm now going to point out is the external environment. Now, contact crime trends. The medium-term expenditure strategic framework says that between 2014 and 2019, that contact crime should be down to 2% a year. But now, if you look at the reality, it's actually only gone down 2.4% since 2012. That's about 6 years. And that's off the back of a very large reduction So basically what's happened is total contact crimes, which are pretty much violent crimes of all kinds, have been going down, are still going down slightly, but it's kind of plateaued slightly. This is according to police statistics. That hides the crimes which are causing the increases in public fear. So if you look at the victims of crime survey, whether people feel safe walking around at night, it's about 70% say they don't, and that's been going up. The proportion of people who say that they feel like crime is going up in the areas is almost 42%. It's much higher than the 31% who say that crime has stabilized, or 27% who think crime is going down. So people are feeling fearful, and the reason why they're feeling fearful is because of two crimes, robberies and murder. Seems quite obvious. Murder, people get killed. And that causes a huge drama and trauma to a lot of people. And we've seen the murder rate going up by 21.8%. Not the rate, sorry, the murder, numbers of murders going up 21.8%. It's about 13% increase in the rate. So the real 6 years, murder has gone up. And of course we know that armed robberies gone up. Armed robberies are committed by small numbers of people who repeatedly commit the same crime over and over again. If they get away with it, more people start doing it. But it's actually always going to be a small number who commit virtually 80% of the robberies. Most people don't commit robberies. And that's gone up dramatically. So that demonstrates a severe problem facing policing. Just on contact crimes, it is important to realize as well is that that basket of crimes, 54% of contact crimes are assaults. Okay, so that means those are very difficult crimes to police. They largely take place between people who know each other. Most of the time it's males who've been drinking, get in an argument, assault each other. Some of that's domestic violence. So you can have this, if you're looking at contact crime, it looks like it's going down, but the crimes that are causing fear, the other key measure, are going up. And that's why we always call for the disaggregation of crime statistics. And if you revisit the National Crime Prevention Strategy, you'll see there's a strong argument for that. You can't aggregate crimes that are very different. Different, how you respond to murder, how you respond to rape, and how you respond to robberies are quite different kinds of strategies if you want to be effective. Okay, now that's the performance side of things. On the conduct side of things, we've heard a bit about civil claims. Well, you can just see a dramatic, it's a 778% increase over the last 10 years. You can see from 2005, 6, 7 to 2009, it was pretty much stable and stopped in 1 year. Started going up slowly, but from about 2012, quite big increases. That is amount paid out. That means courts have found wrongdoing on the part of police and ordered the police to pay damages to the victim. This is not just the contingent liability that I've looked at. Not all of this is a result of poor police behavior. Sometimes there might be legitimate defenses. There might have been, there's no intention to commit this conduct, but the police are liable, that kind of thing. Anyway, it is one indicator. You can't, if it's one indicator, so of course we look at the public satisfaction of police, and you can see that the general trend has been going down, slight increase, but generally going down. Anyway, there are other indicators, but we just know that there's a problem. Okay. So, what should be happening is that the high-end outcomes, the police improving trust, making us safer, all these indicators in the annual performance plan should be clearly supporting that. We should very clearly see an indicator that says if we do X at this amount, we're going to build public trust or we're going to improve public safety. And the one big challenge we have is that there is this focus on bringing crime numbers down to targets. Now, there is a remarkable amount of information internationally on how this not only doesn't work, but is actually harmful to policing outcomes. Because crime measured by the police is a challenge that they're facing. Not all crimes are reported. So basically, what typically happens, and there's a great book written by Eli B. Silverman, 2012, where he does a history of how crime targets have resulted in manipulation statistics in places like Australia, France, the UK, and most big cities in America. In fact, in 2013, one of the British police agencies admitted that they've been manipulating crime stats to make things look good. In Scotland, 2013, the same thing happens. Everywhere in the world where the police are given targets on crime statistics, they will, and you don't improve their capacity, you don't give them more resources, you don't give them better training, you don't give them better skills, the only way they can do it is by not recording crime, by recording crime differently. So this is not unique to South Africa, this is a historical policing problem globally. And if we look at these targets in this medium-term framework, what we're asking the police to do is that by 2020, they must record 118,846 fewer cases of serious crimes. we must ask them to record 116,000 cases fewer of violent crimes, and they must reduce the numbers of cases that they record of crimes against women by 48,506 and against children by 4,800. So in fact, if we don't improve resourcing, skill levels, better management, all these difficult things, we might have a situation in which we'll get these targets, but at the cost of police building trust and legitimacy in the community. Because people will simply go to police stations, and we get a lot of complaints ourselves if we refer on to the police, back to police, about people who go to police stations, try open cases, everything, stolen laptops, serious assaults, and they simply won't get help. Because the station commissioners are under massive pressure to get the crime rate down. So, when it comes to targets, one big point I want to make is that the literature and the experience shows that you can have targets, but mostly for internal issues. Paying invoices within 30 days, what proportion? How many criminal complaints have you got open against police? How long is it taking to resolve those? What are the outcomes? You can say we want to increase our capacity around that. We want to make sure we have enough vehicles, bulletproof vests, firearms. So you can put targets. When it comes to the police out there, the indicators should not have targets. There should be measures of what your police are achieving. As soon as you put targets to it, you must increase this by 70% or reduce this by 70%. Police officers around the world find ways of achieving their targets, and you immediately undermine the integrity of the system. So ideally what you want to do is you want to say, what are we achieving? We've got this budget, we're trying to have so many patrols, we're trying to make arrests, we're trying to deal with violent crime, crimes against women. The indicators should be measured, but they should just give us an indicator. We then put strategies in place and see if those strategies are affecting the indicator. If you put a target there for things like crime, things like arrests, and I'll get to that in a moment, we will achieve those targets at the expense of more important outcomes for police. So that's a big lesson, and I hope that that happens going forward. Now the reason about crime, and you know this, the reporting rates of different crimes are quite low in some cases, assault less than half, rape, 1 in 9 is a commonly accepted figure. So these, you know, if you think about what's there in this annual plan, there's the minister saying we've got a 6-point plan to make it easier for women to report rape. We're going to make sure that every victim who goes to police stations will be treated with dignity and respect. That goes against the target to reduce rape. Because what's going to happen is that if the police are starting to be seen to be helping rape victims, there's a chance that the rape figure could go up 9 times. And then your police station commanders being, so they go to community and say, we want you to come and report sexual offences to us, we want to help you, we've got victim support services, and they get punished because their rape stuff is going to go up. Because there's a target saying they must get it done. So that's, again, that's one of the problems you have, is that you might have a situation in which those very good plans to try and help victims don't get implemented because you're punishing the police office, the station commanders, and the police officers if their crime rates go up. At the launch of Operation Crackdown in 2000, I was in Hillbrow. There were about 100 extra cops on duty, 24-hour shifts in the first week, and the crime rate up in some cases about 15%. Because suddenly the residents of Hillbrow saw more police, and they started reporting more crime. So initially it looked like, well, you know, this wasn't working. Over time it starts going down, but you need to be very careful about where you put targets. And the literature says, and I'll get into it, how you do that. Also, just different places have different reporting levels. This is a good community survey of the Western Cape Community Survey showing that different precincts have quite big differences in the proportion of people who say they reported the victimization of police or not. And a big correlation is just how easy and accessible the police are. So if there's, once again, in the APP, we're going to open up new satellite stations, we're going to build new police stations. That's not going to reduce the reporting rate. More people have access to police, you're going to see more crime getting reported. And you also know that the reporting rates have been declined. This next one is from the Victims of Crime Survey, just showing quite big reductions for assault and big reductions for sexual offence. And of course, when fewer people report these crimes, it looks like the crime stats are going down, and then we reward the police. But in fact, declining reporting rates internationally are generally seen as a measure of public trust in the police, not in the measure of the actual crime. So, really, I'm not going to go into all the detail, but there are books on this, and it's really worth understanding that there is a body of knowledge that just says, don't use crime targets to measure the police. Use crime statistics as a measure of the workload that they're facing, the challenges that are happening to them, and measure them on what they control and how they respond to those crime figures. If they respond well, those crime figures will go down. But don't put the target on the crime figure. Let the crime figure be as accurate as possible. And a good quote from a SAPS member, if before the Khayelitsha Commission inquiry, said you can have the figures going down, but the crime levels are still very high. So there's a distinction between the statistics and the reality on the ground. So this time they're fighting the figures, not the reality. That's from an operational experience, Coffee knows this, and you'll speak to many police officials and I'll tell you the same. Okay. It's not that you can never use crime just as a way of assessing police performance. And you'll have people say, but we've got to use crime. Of course. They're there, they're measurable. But the literature says that there should be at least 8 criteria in place before you use crime figures. Now, for example, a big figure that we should be looking at is the Sustainable Development Goals, number 16, we adhere to these. So they want to see figures of crime, and they're really limiting it to murder, because the most reliable crime statistic we have. And so they'll be assessing countries on the extent to which murder is going up and down by sex and age, and whether there's conflict-related deaths. The police already have a lot of data on this. So their 2015-16 doc analysis shows that about 59% of murders are related to social behavior or interpersonal violence, mostly young men who get into arguments after drinking. That is driving almost 60% of our murder rate. But almost 30%, 27% are linked to criminal acts, or 80% of that being robberies. So robberies go up, you're going to have murders go up. Okay? And then 30% of murders are related to group behavior. Vigilantism is very prominent, gang violence, taxi violence, and so forth. So in each locality, this might change. In the Western Cape, gang activity might be a much bigger contributor to violence, to murder, than in other places. And the police could possibly nationally get on top of about 40% of the murder. They deal with intergroup violence properly using intelligence. They get on top of the robbery. They should actually be able to bring murders down. We need to have other strategies to deal with some of the other murders. But they could start seeing, they couldn't make an impact on murder. So the way that police can use crime statistics is when you say we are going to go after a highly policeable crime. We want to make sure we bring down house robberies, street robberies, carjackings, because we're going to improve our strategies towards that. Between this date and that date, we're going to delegate the following resources to understanding the nature of these criminals, how they operate, the modus operandi. We're going to get intelligence from them. And then we're going to assess what we did and did that have an impact. So there are examples where they don't put targets to the crime, but they say we are aiming to reduce these categories. And the robberies are the most susceptible to good policing. Whether it's in Bogota in Colombia, which managed to reduce robbery by 75% of not allocating any more resources to the police, or that the New York City Police Department, intelligence-driven policing can have a huge impact. And you really want to then, of course, in South Africa, just for example, so we've seen murder going up and robberies going up. Maybe 6 years ago, we should have seen these kind of APPs. The percentage of increasing crime intelligence products related to networks and individuals linked to murder and robbery. So the intelligence are not just creating products, they're going after the people and the networks involved in the murders and robberies. And the percentage of crime intelligence products that result in detection and cases going to court. Percentage of higher murder and robbery precincts that have empirically based reduction strategies, and that can prove that they're doing what they're doing to reduce these things. Percentage of clusters or stations dedicated murder and robbery units. Percentage increases in detection rates for murder and robbery. Percentage increases in cases to court and conviction rates. Now, if you had those kinds of indicators driving the police, we wouldn't see 6 years of increases in these crimes. Only 13% of the precincts record 50% of our murder rate in South Africa. So if we just made sure that each of these, and here's a map of where these take place, if those 13% of police stations had proper, dedicated anti-crime strategies, support from provincial and national intelligence, we should see massive increases in improvements in these cases, in these crimes. And there's a lot of data on when they take place. 50% just take place in 2 days, basically Friday to Sunday. That's 50% of your murders in these cases. So you know, now you know when you must have a lot of cops on duty and that kind of thing. The Gauteng police have really done something like this. So we know that the police in South Africa have the skills and ability to do this. So just between 2009 and 2011, they implemented a dedicated aggravated robbery strategy. I evaluated the strategy in September of 2009. In the first 9 months, they decreased the arrest rate for suspects by 100%, increased the cases going to court by 30%, and increased the conviction rate by 14%. Because they had very clear protocols. They had 22 dedicated task teams working at a cluster level, daily intelligence being fed to them, when there was an immediate complaint of a robbery taking place or had just ended, they had strategic place rapid response vehicles to try and watch these guys getting away from the scene of the crime. So don't rush to the scene of the crime always. But they would have first responders to within half an hour to cordon off the scene so that within 2 hours, LCRC, the local criminal record center, people could come in and get forensics. So when they started arresting people, they could link them to crimes. And within 2 years, they brought house robbery down in the whole of Gauteng by 21%, business robberies by almost 20%, 19.8%, and car hijacking down by 32%. Now compare that to what happened from 2000 to 2004. The strategy was disbanded, there was change in leadership, and these crimes started going up again. So we know it's possible. This is not a pipe dream that we can get expect our police to do this. Okay, just a few concerns on some of the key current measures. The one that really just stood out for me, and it's also, again, there's a lot of evidence on this. The police are expected to increase the numbers of people arrested and charged for drugs by 256% by 2021. That means that this last year, they arrested 292,000 people. By 2020, they're supposed to arrest over 1 million people. Now, on the face of it, sounds great. Sounds like, well, you know, drugs is a problem. Except that nowhere in the world has policing helped reduce the harm caused by drugs in society. It doesn't reduce the demand for drugs. It doesn't reduce the street price for drugs. Because drugs and the harm it causes is a public health problem. And if you ask the cops now, with declining resources, to start going and making these massive increases of arrests, you're going to have, they'll get these targets. Except that rather than going after people who are killing people in their homes, raping women, and involved in serious organized crime who are planned criminals, they're going to be going out and arresting people under bridges and in parks for smoking joints, marijuana, which is about 65 to 80% of what the police do. So this is an extremely dangerous target. I would say if you want to deal with drugs from a policing perspective, identify the key drugs you want to go after, shut down the labs, confiscate them at the boarding points, dismantle the networks and the criminal syndicates that are bringing in harmful drugs or trading in harmful drugs. Then we'll see big changes. These big numbers, it's going to be a war on the poor. It's not going to be the rich people in Sandton and in Cavendish smoking joints in their big houses. It's going to be poor people on the streets that are going to be arrested. And that, we know mass arrests just fundamentally breaks down what I said earlier. The relationship between young men, who are going to be mostly arrested for this, and the police. And you're going to have a war between the police and young men because of this target. So I hope the police don't take this target very seriously. Just a bit about the police conduct. There's one indicator there that talks about finalizing police disciplinary cases in 60 days, which is a good thing, except it doesn't tell you about the quality of those cases. This graph from the SAPS annual report shows that in 2011-12, almost just about under 37% of all hearings ended with no sanction against the police officer. In other words, the case was either withdrawn or the police officer was found not guilty. By last year, this had increased to 50.6%. That means even if there's an investigation into a police officer because there's a complaint that they've committed some kind of misconduct, and the investigation gathers evidence, which is then looked at by a senior police officer, and they say, on the evidence before us, including a statement by the subject officer, we're going to have a disciplinary hearing because there's prima facie evidence of wrongdoing. They then have to appoint a trial judge, a trial prosecutor judge, a trial officer, get a room in place, get the transcription, make sure that there's legal or union representatives to the subject officer. That's a big, long process and complicated. That's why they're trying to get it done in 60 days, because often these things drag out. In half of those cases, there's absolutely no harm. The case gets withdrawn or the subject officer is found not guilty, which shows that the system is not working. Okay, and the number of police officers where there's evidence of misconduct that are recommended for dismissal has consistently declined. Only 323 hearings last year ended in a recommendation of dismissal. Those police officers are then allowed to appeal, so that actually far fewer actually get dismissed. Now, you don't have targets on saying you must dismiss this. You want fair, proper systems. But the problem of the disciplinary system related to combat is not only that they're not getting cases done in 60 days. There's a whole lot of problems there. And we need to see more indicators that look at, are the trial judges properly trained, the prosecuting officers, who's making these decisions? Why are so many cases falling apart? And then look at measures that try and help us understand that and address those challenges. detection rates is another big issue, and it's similar to crime rates. We're just talking about detection rates for contact crime. The medium-term expenditure strategic framework thought that the detection rate should be at around 66% for total contact crimes, and about a conviction of 83% of true crimes by now. That's obviously not happening. But you can see that that's going down. So just putting a target saying it must stop or it must go up again, we need to understand what needs to be the indicator that we're tracking to see what will change this. Now, there is training of police officers. So I think it's 6,000 detectives. Training in assault is not enough to ensure that cases are properly detected and go to court. So I think there are disconnects, and I just want to point these out, that if we're sort of going to be looking at these things, we might miss a lot of the quality. Some of the other issues really about, you know, things like percentage of learners declared competent. In the past, one of the challenges with that is that rather than just assessing whether people are competent, if you've got a target to meet, 97% of your people not too competent, there's a chance that the integrity of the system breaks down. People get passed in order to meet the target, not because they're actually competent. There's evidence of that in the past. There's a lot of indicators around police integrity and conduct. We've got if you look in the National Commissioner's strategic objectives, there are things like talking about fighting corruption and dealing complaints and that. Those indicators should be there. How many complaints are opened against police officers every year? And what happens to those cases? You know, so those are the kind of indicators that you're looking at. Are the complaints being processed? What proportion are going to disciplinary hearings, counselling, going to court? That gives you a much better sense of the kind of overall challenges facing there. And then obviously when you're talking about conduct and integrity, you're not only looking at the negatives, how many cops are we punishing for being bad, but what has been done to promote or assist or reward cops who are doing well? How many awards are given, that kind of thing? Also good indicators just to show that you're not just looking at integrity and behaviour from a negative perspective. I've talked about the detective services, the DPCI has already been mentioned. It's quite concerning to think about the state of corruption in our country, how low those targets are, but I think it's to do with their capacity. The issue about complexity, especially organized crime. You know, the danger with when you put numbers to organized crime is that one case of organized crime, one project, could, you know, dismantle a massive drug syndicate that is bringing hundreds of millions of rands of drugs into the country, but you could have 20 smaller syndicates that are low level that don't even come close to that. So sometimes the numbers on organized crime is supposed to just look at in terms of complexity. You must look at the amount of money being involved to determine whether that case, 30 cases or 15 cases or 5 cases, are big important cases or they're not so important. And of course, the bigger, more important are, you can't usually deal with them in 1 year. So looking at, you know, 3 to 5 years sometimes for a really big syndicate to be taken down through public intelligence. The crime intelligence, one of the issues about that is there's lots of figures about this. Reports being generated, I mentioned earlier, what does that mean? You can generate reports, but are those reports giving actionable information to the police to affect arrests and support investigation and prosecution? And then often you see the indicators kind of remain static for the period 2019 to 2020. It doesn't suggest that their plans to improve or change. So I know sometimes the police don't know. We're looking at our budget reductions. We're not going to increase things, but that is something that's worked for me. I've said most of this is moving forward, so I'm not going to repeat it. I think just that it was encouraging in the strategic plan of the National Commissioner in professionalizing or transforming the police service. He says we need to revisit this. He actually says we need to revisit these indicators. We need to start looking at how we better measure our performance, training our leaders, our managers, and important partnerships. So indicators of policing, if you want people to understand them, buy into them, ideally, first of all, I'd say make sure that your operational commanders, people actually have to implement them, are part of the process. Because I've had, just the other day, I spoke to a captain in a rapid response unit. He's in the last year, and he's being really pressurized to increase his arrest rates. And so they're arresting lots of people for smoking marijuana, but they used to be arresting more people for more serious crimes, serious assaults, rapes, and murders. And now he's worried because he's meeting his performance targets on one hand, but he doesn't feel he's actually making his community safer. So we need their voices into this process. And the issue of partnerships beyond this, there are organizations, there are universities, the policing departments, who could probably make very valuable contributions by looking at what kind of indicators would work best. And then thirdly on this, the police are part of criminal justice. So they shouldn't be making indicators that are not going to help assist the courts and correctional services, and that's the same for all of them. So they should be looking at universal indicators that are all working towards. And so we say we want to reduce murder, What is the police going to do about it? What is the prosecuting authority going to do about it? What is prison going to do about it? What is home affairs going to do about it? And then there's a whole body of violence prevention which doesn't involve the police at all. We're talking about social development, talking about education and health can play vital roles in reducing murder. So let's hope that we will see the development of a new strategic framework for 2020 to 2025 and that a new approach is undertaken to develop these indicators and that we start seeing really better partnerships. I know my colleagues from Corruption Watch are going to talk a bit about that. Because we all want to play a role, we all can play a role, and I think the more brains, the more people we put together looking at these complex problems, the more likely are we to get to a very positive outcome. So thank you very much again for inviting me today, and I look forward to your questions and assisting our cat.
Thank you very much, Mr. Nguyen, for your input. We appreciate Honourable Kalabaunat, Honourable Bele, and Honourable Mhlongo.
Thanks very much, and thank you, as ever. Wonderful input. Look, it has, as you've referred to, become obvious that the manner in which the decrease and the pressure to decrease crime in specific stations has resulted actually in citizens being turned away. I know Director went around recently, you may not do that. But the very fact that the people at the top had to send out a director saying you can't turn people away, when they say, actually my station border ends at the street next door, so you have to go 50 kilometres to the next station. And that's what's been happening for a very long time. And it's down to this drive to bring your numbers down. We've had stations actually wheeling out files in wheelbarrows and burning them in the back of the yard. And they were given monetary rewards at Mountain Rise Police Station for bringing crime down. The way they did it was to burn files. Last I heard, they were all advising SAT, now moved into other positions, advising SAT on how police become criminals. I've heard a great deal about what you're saying is perhaps the cause of, as you say, now arresting 16-year-olds with a single marijuana cigarette and not arresting a single importer, exporter, manufacturer who's the syndicate head anywhere. There seems to be less and less of that going on. I haven't heard of a big bust in a very long time. But what are what do you see as the way to overhaul and drag both the system of measurement, the reward system, which has become now totally corrupt, and basically pulling the entire criminal justice system into the same party, because they all have, there's no relationship whatsoever between the targets we look at here, the targets they look at in correctional services, the targets they look at in justice. They're all totally different. They are of absolutely no use from one to the other, and yet they've spent, I've lost count, Chair, gabillions, a billion, I don't know how much, on the so-called revamp of the criminal justice system. Is there a way, at some international best practice, that this country could look at and say, you know what, they do it best. Why aren't we doing it like that? A second question. There is, and I've been through all of these documents, there's virtually no reference at all to the extremely brutal torture and murder of rural residents that is now almost prevalent. Farmers, farm managers, farm workers are in extreme danger. I've seen stats saying it's up to 5 times more dangerous or more to be a person who lives in a rural area than a person who lives in a town. And they're far more likely to be murdered or tortured or both. There's literally no reference to the situation. We've had, for example, 6 attacks in the last 72 hours. 2 of them murders. The one took place while we've been talking around this table. That was in the Eastern Cape. Now, the rural strategy, and I've been to stations, and they say, yes, we've, and they tick the boxes, literally tick the boxes. And I say, okay, so you know what it is. Is it being implemented? Oh, no, we don't have the vehicles or the manpower, but we've ticked all the boxes. So it's never been lifted off the page to actually achieve something. I know the stats very deliberately removed the rural murder stats off the books. I think it was in 2006. And now it's left up to various agricultural unions and that to give the figures, which seem to be on the increase again. So any thoughts on that and how... I know in this committee members have asked the staff to put the statistics back so that we can see the status in our rural areas, but they simply ignore us. So I'm interested in your thoughts on that and how to measure it and how to measure the efficacy of the rural stations, which sometimes, you know, what they're doing now is putting a police officer in a private helicopter to get to a crime scene. So the SAPs are relying on private individuals to transport them to the attack scene. That's an absurd situation. Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable Bailey.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for the presentation. Just two questions from my side. The first is in relation to the civil claims issue on slide 13. That only speaks to the payout amounts. But I was just wondering if do you, as the ISS, have and do you analyze the numbers of actual civil claims and what the trends are in relation to that? Because I think that might be a more useful measure alongside the payout sums in terms of tracking that deterioration of police conduct, because that'll speak to either there's more incidents happening in reality and therefore justice being pursued through civil claims, or people are opting to go that route as opposed to trusting either IP investigation or because of their resource constraints, or trusting that doing the normal complaint at a police station will result in justice. I mean, I certainly know from my personal experience years ago where a case of police abuse resulted in a formal written warning. I'm never going to do it again. I would go straight and sue the bastards, you know. So, yeah. And then secondly, I'm sure the ISS has explained to SAP senior management about the insights and the rationale relating to the irrationality of using crime stats and arrest figures, at least in a misplaced way, as performance indicators. I'm sure the generals and all of those supposedly enlightened people at the top of the SAPs have been told this. And what has been their response to and defense for continuing to follow the approach? I mean, surely once you receive, you know, insights and arguments for a reform, that should be taken on board, and it follows that some kind of change happens. So if they continue to do so, do they give the feedback? Do they give an explanation to say, we hear you, but no, we're going to keep going down this line because this is our position, our understanding, and our approach. And then thirdly, it's not in the presentation explicitly, but it's an issue that's come on my radar recently, is this contradiction, because I guess maybe because it speaks to the issue of the theme of contradiction that you highlighted in parts of the presentation. There's this paradox in the SAPs where in order to earn higher remuneration, you have to go up the ranks. But beyond a certain threshold, as you continue going up the ranks, so when you pass that rank threshold, you are removed from the operational environment and you go into management, which means you're in an office, you're desk-bound, you're in boardrooms, and your experience, knowledge, insights, skills gained in the operational field in those years of climbing the rank system are now lost. Yes, you might guide, you know, the devising of strategies and monitoring and so on, but you aren't on the ground applying it at the interface. So that paradox between rank and remuneration is causing an issue. Have you looked at that? Do you have any insights and any suggestions about how we address that? Because it's a great pity that, you know, a detective with 15, 20 plus years of experience, in order to earn more, because they deserve to earn more, have to be taken out of out of the operational environment. Yeah, thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Bailey. Honourable Mushlungu and then Honourable Molobachi.
Thank you, Chairperson. You know, on page 13, there is an indication that as years go by, there is also a booming increase of claims against policy. I want to find out from you, is it maybe fueled by the economic decline situation where the living standards of our people are getting worse as years go by, or the hemorrhaging levels of professionalism within policy itself, which means as we are moving up in the number with the number of years, there is a decline also in the professionalism of South African police, thus then fueling this increase of claims against South African police. Or is it maybe fueled by growing awareness of the communities, so that we can then be able to be better positioned to say what are the factors, push and pull factors, that are actually standing behind this? Then secondly, is the question of the performance measurement toolkits. In your own view, would it be best, because as you said in your opening, criminals are getting, you know, I always refer to them as people who operate, you know, just like a bacteria, change it, you understand, bacteriology, they change under, depending on the conditions you subject them to. And they become, you know, the previous culture of a particular bacteria in 1970s. Its behavior is completely different in 2018 because it has been subjected to various kinds of treatment and all that, and it developed and it changed its operandi as well. So criminals are just like that. Now, when you measure this, will you be measuring it at in your own view, will it be best place to measure? Because crime takes place at a local level, and it starts moving from local level, permeating to other areas and all that, either from station level to cluster level, from cluster level to district and province, and international, province to province. Now, to measure this, will it be correct if it is that the toolkit is applied at a station level or cluster level? So that we can then be able to see what is it that makes the particular province fail, and also what then will be the requirements of us as the committee to push for further resourcing of those particular areas. We went, for example, on our oversight visit to KZN. We found that Batabisa police station was completely under-resourced and completely neglected. And yet you have a national game park and all that, and serious poaching is taking place there, and that is a serious economic activity, which then spirals even beyond the borders of the country. And now, so such things, how do we deal with this so that when we meet with the police management, we can then be able to share light along those lines of particular application of these toolkits, rather than that just them, as you are correctly saying, I have seen this thing on my own. That's why I don't even give too much damn about these things, because these people are just going to inflate these useless criminals to say that they might have caught a man with a dagger of about 20 kilograms in his pocket or grams in his pocket. And this is part of the statistics. But it is indicators just like these Guptas who were bagged yesterday up there. Just bagged because of dairy farm. But they had dairy farm, 200 and something million. What about the billions that they have looted in the country? If then the media didn't report about dairy farm, it means it will also be just covered. It's just a disgrace. To me, it's just a disgrace. Because that thing indicates failure by by our South African police, particularly the DCI, to say, if then the media didn't actually raise a hype about the daring in the Freddie Farm, would it actually then be in the media today? What about all these things that they've been doing, causing about any sort of financial flows, into running into billions that are not even attended to? Where are we going to recover them? Then lastly, is the question of disciplinary hearings. On page 29, is this caused by the weaknesses in the code itself? That you find some officers just going scot-free? I don't know, because I think we will deal when the time when the chairperson gives one the chance, whereby I personally have got serious quite pessimistic about the application of the South African Police Disciplinary Code. Because those people who ought to be actually then rewarded for doing good work are the ones who are actually leaving the service. And we end up being left with thugs, complete thugs, who are very dangerous even to the lives of other officers who are dedicated to their work. The simple case of that police officer who was abusing a woman in KZN, whereby the whistleblower finds himself now being moving to disciplinary hearings after disciplinary hearings for actually raising the alarm to say, here is a police officer whose name I can't actually say, who's actually abusing another officer, sexually molesting her. Now, when that police is raising that, subjected to disciplinary hearing, these others are actually ranked up. And that police officer is even deciding now to leave the service. So what the hell is that? Is it because of the weaknesses of the disciplinary code? Or at the end of the day, we shall be left with groups, good policemen and women leaving the service because they find no joy in the service. True, I don't really want to, I just want to know, is it because of the weakness of the code, or just because police senior managers are covering their backs in order to actually keep their dirty cronies in the system? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Munabatsi.
Yeah, thanks, Chairperson. And thank you, Kara. My first question is on the lawsuit. I want to know, in your view, what is bringing them up to make them increase? Is it because our communities are getting more aware of their rights, or the police are more reckless? My next one is on the target that you mentioned, that what that should you suggest that they should be used internally. You suggest that they should be the target that should be used internally. But what I didn't hear you say very well is what should then happen externally. How will you know if crime is increasing or decreasing? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, we're going to take a 10-minute tea break, 10 minutes, and then we'll come back for the responses. Thank you very much.
Gracias.